eyes. Her eyes are all blue, no whites in them. I talk to her and tell her about you, about seeing the Reverend Mother on Caladan. Paul opened his eyes. And the thing you tell this strange girl about seeing me? Did it happen today? Paul thought about this, then, yes. I tell the girl you came and put a stamp of strangeness on me. Stamp of strangeness. The old woman breathed, and again she shot a glance at Jessica, returned her attention to Paul. Tell me truly now, Paul, do you often have dreams of things that happen afterward exactly as you dreamed them? Yes. And I've dreamed about that girl before. Oh. You know her? I will know her. Tell me about her. Again, Paul closed his eyes. We're in a little place in some rocks where it's sheltered. It's almost night, but it's hot, and I can see patches of sand out of an opening in the rocks. We're waiting for something. For me to go meet some people. And she's frightened, but trying to hide it from me, and I'm excited. And she says, tell me about the waters of your home world, Usul. Paul opened his eyes. Isn't that strange? My home world's Caladan. I'd never even heard of a planet called Usul. Is there more to this dream? Jessica prompted. Yes. But maybe she was calling me Usul, Paul said. I just thought of that. Again, he closed his eyes. She asks me to tell her about the waters, and I take her hand, and I say I'll tell her a poem, and I tell her the poem, but I have to explain some of the words, like beach and surf and seaweed and seagulls. What poem? The Reverend Mother asked. Paul opened his eyes. It's just one of Gurney Halleck's tone poems for sad times. Behind Paul, Jessica began to recite. I remember salt smoke from beach fire and shadows under the pines. Solid. Clean. Fixed. Seagulls perched at the tip of land. White upon green. And a wind comes through the pines to sway the shadows. The seagulls spread their wings. Lift. And fill the sky with screeches. And I hear the wind blowing across our beach. And the surf. And I see that our fire has scorched the seaweed. That's the one, Paul said. The old woman stared at Paul, then, young man, as a proctor of the Bene Gesserit, I seek the Kwisatz Haderach, the male who truly can become one of us. Your mother sees this possibility in you, but she sees with the eyes of a mother. Possibility I see, too, but no more. She fell silent, and Paul saw that she wanted him to speak. He waited her out. Presently she said, As you will, then. You've depths in you, that I'll grant. May I go now? He asked. Don't you want to hear what the Reverend Mother can tell you about the Kwisatz Haderach? Jessica asked. She said those who tried for it died. But I can help you with a few hints at why they failed. The Reverend Mother said. She talks of hints, Paul thought. She doesn't really know anything. And he said, Hint, then. And be damned to me? She smiled wryly, a criss-cross of wrinkles in the old face. Very well. That which submits rules. He felt astonishment. She was talking about such elementary things as tension within meaning. Did she think his mother had taught him nothing at all? That's a hint, he asked. We're not here to bandy words or quibble over their meaning, the old woman said. The willow submits to the wind and prospers until one day it is many willows, a wall against the wind. This is the willow's purpose. Paul stared at her. She said purpose, and he felt the word buffet him, reinfecting him with terrible purpose. He experienced a sudden anger at her, fatuous old witch with her mouth full of platitudes. "You think I could be this Kwisatz Haderach?" he said. "You talk about me, but you haven't said one thing about what we can do to help my father. I've heard you talking to my mother. You talk as though my father were dead." "Well, he isn't."
"If there were a thing to be done for him, we'd have done it," the old woman growled. "We may be able to salvage you. Doubtful, but possible. For your father, nothing. When you've learned to accept that as a fact, you've learned a real Bene Gesserit lesson."
Paul saw how the words shook his mother. He glared at the old woman. How could she say such a thing about his father? What made her so sure? His mind seethed with resentment. The Reverend Mother looked at Jessica.
"You've been training him in the way. I've seen the signs of it. I'd have done the same in your shoes, and devil take the rules."
Jessica nodded.
"Now I caution you," said the old woman, "to ignore the regular order of training. His own safety requires the voice. He already has a good start in it, but we both know how much more he needs, and that desperately."
She stepped close to Paul, stared down at him.
"Goodbye, young human. I hope you make it. But if you don't, well, we shall yet succeed."
Once more she looked at Jessica. A flicker sign of understanding passed between them. Then the old woman swept from the room, her robes hissing, with not another backward glance. The room and its occupants already were shut from her thoughts. But Jessica had caught one glimpse of the Reverend Mother's face as she turned away. There had been tears on the seamed cheeks. The tears were more unnerving than any other word or sign that had passed between them this day.
You have read that Muad'Dib had no playmates his own age on Caladan. The dangers were too great. But Muad'Dib did have wonderful companion teachers. There was Gurney Halleck, the troubadour warrior. You will sing some of Gurney's songs as you read along in this book. There was Thufir Hawat, the old Mentat master of assassins, who struck fear even into the heart of the Padishah Emperor. There were Duncan Idaho, the sword master of the Ginnars, Dr. Wellington Yui, a name black in treachery but bright in knowledge, the Lady Jessica, who guided her son in the Bene Gesserit way, and of course the Duke Leto, whose qualities as a father have long been overlooked. From A Child's History of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Thufir Hawat slipped into the training room of Castle Caladan, closed the door softly. He stood there a moment, feeling old and tired and storm-leathered. His left leg ached where it had been slashed once in the service of the old Duke. 3 generations of them now, he thought. He stared across the big room, bright with the light of noon pouring through the skylights, saw the boy seated with back to the door, intent on papers and charts spread across an L-table. "How many times must I tell that lad never to settle himself with his back to a door?" Howard cleared his throat. Paul remained bent over his studies. A cloud shadow passed over the skylights. Again, Howard cleared his throat. Paul straightened, spoke without turning.
"I know. I'm sitting with my back to a door."
Howard suppressed a smile, strode across the room. Paul looked up at the grizzled old man who stopped at a corner of the table. Howard's eyes were 2 pools of alertness in a dark and deeply seamed face.
"I heard you coming down the hall, and I heard you open the door."
"The sounds I make could be imitated."
"I'd know the difference."
He might at that, Howard thought. That witch mother of his is giving him the deep training, certainly. I wonder what her precious school thinks of that. Maybe that's why they've sent the old proctor here, to whip our dear Lady Jessica into line. Howard pulled up a chair across from Paul, sat down facing the door. He did it pointedly, leaned back and studied the room. It struck him as an odd place suddenly. A stranger place, with most of its hardware already gone off to Arrakis. A training table remained, and a fencing mirror with its crystal prisms quiescent, the target dummy beside it patched and padded, looking like an ancient foot soldier maimed and battered in the wars. There stand I, Hawat thought.
Thufir, what are you thinking?
Hawat looked at the boy.
I was thinking we'll all be out of here soon and likely never see the place again.
Does that make you sad?
Sad? Nonsense. Parting with friends is a sadness. A place is only a place.
Hawat glanced at the charts on the table.
And Arrakis is just another place.
Did my father send you up to test me?
Hawat scowled. The boy had such observing ways about him. He nodded.
You're thinking it'd been nicer if he'd come up himself, but you must know how busy he is. He'll be along later.
I've been studying about the storms on Arrakis.
Storms? I see.
They sound pretty bad.
It's too cautious a word, bad. Those storms build up across 6,000 or 7,000 kilometers of flatlands, feed on anything that can give them a push. Coriolis force, other storms, anything that has an ounce of energy in it. They can blow up to 700 kilometers an hour, loaded with everything loose that's in their way, sand, dust, everything. They can eat flesh off bones and etch the bones to slivers.
Why don't they have weather control?
Arrakis has special problems, costs are higher, and there'd be maintenance and the like. The Guild wants a dreadful high price for satellite control, and your father's house isn't one of the big rich ones, lad, you know that.
Have you ever seen the Fremen?
The lad's mind is darting all over today, Howard thought.
Like as not, I have seen them. There's little to tell them from the folk of the Graben and Sink. They all wear those great flowing robes. And they stink to heaven in any closed space. It's from those suits they wear, call them still suits, that reclaim the body's own water.
Paul swallowed, suddenly aware of the moisture in his mouth, remembering a dream of thirst. That people could want so for water they had to recycle their body moisture struck him with a feeling of desolation.
Water's precious there.
Hawat nodded, thinking, perhaps I'm doing it, getting across to him the importance of this planet as an enemy. It's madness to go in there without that caution in our minds. Paul looked up at the skylight, aware that it had begun to rain. He saw the spreading wetness on the grey metaglass.
Water.
You'll learn a great concern for water. As the Duke's son, you'll never want for it, but you'll see the pressures of thirst all around you.
Paul wet his lips with his tongue. Thinking back to the day a week ago and the ordeal with the Reverend Mother, she, too, had said something about water starvation. You'll learn about the funeral plains, she'd said, about the wilderness that is empty, the wasteland where nothing lives except the spice and the sandworms. You'll stain your eye pits to reduce the sun glare. Shelter will mean a hollow out of the wind and hidden from view. You'll ride upon your own 2 feet without thopter or ground car or mount. And Paul had been caught more by her tone, sing-song and wavering, than by her words. When you live upon Arrakis, she had said, Chala, the land is empty. The moons will be your friends, the sun your enemy. Paul had sensed his mother come up beside him, away from her post guarding the door. She had looked at the Reverend Mother and asked, Do you see no hope, your reverence? Not for the father. And the old woman had waved Jessica to silence, looked down at Paul. Grave this on your memory, lad. A world is supported by 4 things. She held up 4 big knuckled fingers. The learning of the wise, the justice of the great, the prayers of the righteous, and the valor of the brave. But all of these are as nothing. She closed her fingers into a fist. Without a ruler who knows the art of ruling, make that the science of your tradition. A week had passed since that day with the Reverend Mother. Her words were only now beginning to come into full register. Now, sitting in the training room with Thufir Hawat, Paul felt a sharp pang of fear. He looked across at the Mendhat's puzzled frown. He seems to be getting over it, Howard thought. But that old witch frightened him. Why did she do it?
Thufir, will Arrakis be as bad as she said?
Nothing could be that bad.
Howard forced a smile.
Take those Fremen, for example, the renegade people of the desert. By first approximation analysis, I can tell you there are many, many more of them than the Imperium suspects. People live there, lad, great many people, and they hate Harkonnens with a bloody passion. You must not breathe a word of this, lad. I tell you only as your father's helper.
My father has told me of Seleucia Secundus. Do you know, Thufir, it sounds much like Arrakis. Perhaps not quite as bad, but much like it.
We do not really know of Seleucia Secundus today. Only what it was like long ago, mostly. But what is known, you're right on that score.
Will the Fremen help us?
It's a possibility.
Howard stood up.
I leave today for Arrakis. Meanwhile, you take care of yourself for an old man who's fond of you, eh? Come round here like the good lad and sit facing the door. It's not that I think there's any danger in the castle. It's just a habit I want you to form.
Paul got to his feet, moved around the table.
You're going today?
Today it is. And you'll be following tomorrow. Next time we meet, it'll be on the soil of your new world.
He gripped Paul's right arm at the bicep.
Keep your knife arm free, eh? And your shield at full charge.
He released the arm, patted Paul's shoulder, whirled and strode quickly to the door.
Thufir!
Howard turned, standing in the open doorway.
Don't sit with your back to any doors.
A grin spread across the seamed old face.
That I won't, lad. Depend on it.
And he was gone, shutting the door softly behind. Paul sat down where Howard had been, straightened the papers. One more day here, he thought. He looked around the room. We're leaving. The idea of departure was suddenly more real to him than it had ever been before. He recalled another thing the old woman had said about a world being the sum of many things, the people, the dirt, the growing things, the moons, the tides, the suns. The unknown sum called nature, a vague summation without any sense of the now. And he wondered, what is the now? The door across from Paul banged open, and an ugly lump of a man lurched through it, preceded by a handful of weapons.
Well, Gurney Halleck, are you the new weapons master?
Halleck kicked the door shut with one heel.
You'd rather I came to play games, I know.
He glanced around the room, noting that Howard's men had already been over it, checking, making it safe for a duke's heir. The subtle code signs were all around. Paul watched the rolling, ugly man set himself back in motion, veer toward the training table with a load of weapons, saw the 9-string baliset slung over Gurney's shoulder with a multi-pick woven through the strings near the head of the fingerboard. Halleck dropped the weapons on the exercise table, lined them up. The rapiers, the bodkins, the kinjals, the slow pellet stunners, the shield belts. The ink-vine scar along his jawline writhed as he turned, casting a smile across the room.
So you don't even have a good morning for me, you young imp. And what barb did you think in old Howard? He passed me in the hall like a man running to his enemy's funeral.
Paul grinned. Of all his father's men, he liked Gurney Halleck best, knew the man's moods and deviltry, his humours, and thought of him more as a friend than as a hired sword. Halleck swung the baliset off his shoulder, began tuning it.
If you won't talk, you won't.
Paul stood and advanced across the room.
Well, Gurney, do we come prepared for music when it's fighting time?
So it's sass for our elders today.
Halleck tried a chord on the instrument, nodded.
Where's Duncan Idaho? Isn't he supposed to be teaching me weaponry?
Duncan's gone to lead the second wave onto Arrakis. All you have left is poor Gurney, who's fresh out of fight and spoiling for music.
He struck another chord, listened to it, smiled.
And it was decided in council that you being such a poor fighter, we'd best teach you the music trade so's you won't waste your life entire.
Maybe you'd better sing me a lay then. I want to be sure how not to do it.
Ah-ha!
Gurney laughed, and he swung into Galatian Girls, his multi-picker blur over the strings as he sang. Oh, the Galatian girls will do it for pearls and the Arricane for water, but if you desire dames like consuming flames, try a Caledonian daughter.
Not bad for such a poor hand with the pick, but if my mother heard you singing a bawdy like that in the castle, she'd have your ears on the outer wall for decoration.
Gurney pulled at his left ear.
Poor decoration, too, they having been bruised so much listening at keyholes while a young lad I know practiced some strange ditties on his balisette.
So you've forgotten what it's like to find sand in your bed?
Paul pulled a shield belt from the table, buckled it fast around his waist.
Then let's fight!
So, it was your wicked hand did that deed. Guard yourself today, young master. Guard yourself.
He grabbed up a rapier, laced the air with it.
I'm a hell fiend out for revenge.
Paul lifted the companion rapier, bent it in his hands, stood in the agile, 1 foot forward. He let his manner go solemn in a comic imitation of Dr. Yui.
What a dolt my father sends me for weaponry. This doltish Gurney Halleck has forgotten the first lesson for a fighting man armed and shielded.
Paul snapped the force button at his waist, felt the crinkled skin tingling of the defensive field at his forehead and down his back, heard external sounds take on characteristic shield-filtered flatness.
In shield fighting, one moves fast on defense, slow on attack. Attack has the sole purpose of tricking the opponent into a misstep, setting him up for the attack sinister. The shield turns the fast blow, admits the slow kinjal.
Paul snapped up the rapier, feinted fast, and whipped it back for a slow thrust, timed to enter a shield's mindless defences. Halleck watched the action, turned at the last minute to let the blunted blade pass his chest.
Speed, excellent. But you were wide open for an underhanded counter with a slip tip.
Paul stepped back, chagrined.
I should whap your backside for such carelessness.
He lifted a naked kinjal from the table and held it up.
This in the hand of an enemy can let out your life's blood. You're an apt pupil, none better, but I've warned you that not even in play do you let a man inside your guard with death in his hand.
I guess I'm not in the mood for it today.
Mood? What has mood to do with it? You fight when the necessity arises, no matter the mood. Mood's a thing for cattle or making love or playing the balisette. It's not for fighting.
I'm sorry, Gurney.
You're not sorry enough.
Halleck activated his own shield, crouched with kinjal out thrust in left hand, the rapier poised high in his right.
Now I say guard yourself for true!
He leaped high to one side, then forward, pressing a furious attack. Paul fell back, parrying. He felt the field crackling as shield edges touched and repelled each other, sensed the electric tingling of the contact along his skin. What's gotten into Gurney? He asked himself. He's not faking this. Paul moved his left hand, dropped his bodkin into his palm from its wrist sheath.
You see a need for an extra blade, eh?
Is this betrayal? Paul wondered. Surely not Gurney. Across the room they fought, thrust and parry, feint and counterfeint. The air within their shield bubbles grew stale from the demands on it that the slow interchange along barrier edges could not replenish. With each new shield contact, the smell of ozone grew stronger. Paul continued to back, but now he directed his retreat toward the exercise table. If I can turn him beside the table, I'll show him a trick, Paul thought. One more step, Gurney. Halleck took the step. Paul directed a parry downward, turned, saw Halleck's rapier catch against the table's edge. Paul flung himself aside, thrust high with rapier, and came in across Halleck's neckline with the bodkin. He stopped the blade an inch from the jugular.
Is this what you seek?
Look down, lad.
Paul obeyed, saw Halleck's kinjal thrust under the table's edge, the tip almost touching Paul's groin.
We'd have joined each other in death, but I'll admit you fought some better when pressed to it. You seem to get the mood.
He grinned wolfishly, the ink vine scar rippling along his jaw.
The way you came at me, would you really have drawn my blood?
Halleck withdrew the kinjal, straightened.
If you'd fought one whit beneath your abilities, I'd have scratched you a good one, a scar you'd remember. I'll not have my favorite pupil fall to the first hearkening tramp who happens along.
Paul deactivated his shield, leaned on the table to catch his breath.
I deserved that, Gurney. But it would have angered my father if you'd hurt me. I'll not have you punished for my failing.
As to that, it was my failing, too. And you needn't worry about a training scar, too. You're lucky you have so few. As to your father, the Duke would punish me only if I failed to make a first-class fighting man out of you. And I'd have been failing there if I hadn't explained the fallacy in this mood thing you've suddenly developed.
Paul straightened, slipped his bodkin back into its wrist sheath.
It's not exactly play we do here.
Paul nodded. He felt a sense of wonder at the uncharacteristic seriousness in Halleck's manner, the sobering intensity. He looked at the beet-coloured ink-vine scar on the man's jaw, remembering the story of how it had been put there by Beast Raban in a Harkonnen slave pit on Geardy Prime, and Paul felt a sudden shame that he had doubted Halleck even for an instant. It occurred to Paul then that the making of Halleck's scar had been accompanied by pain. A pain as intense, perhaps, as that inflicted by a reverend mother. He thrust this thought aside. It chilled their world.
I guess I did hope for some play today. Things are so serious around here lately.
Halleck turned away to hide his emotions. Something burned in his eyes. There was pain in him. Like a blister, all that was left of some lost yesterday that time had pruned off him. How soon this child must assume his manhood, Halleck thought. How soon he must read that form within his mind, that contract of brutal caution to enter the necessary fact on the necessary line. Please list your next of kin. Halleck spoke without turning.
I sense the play in you, lad, and I'd like nothing better than to join in it. But this no longer can be play. Tomorrow we go to Arrakis. Arrakis is real. The Harkonnens are real.
Paul touched his forehead with his rapier blade held vertical. Halleck turned, saw the salute, and acknowledged it with a nod. He gestured to the practice dummy.
Now, we'll work on your timing. Let me see you catch that thing sinister. I'll control it from over here where I can have a full view of the action, and I warn you, I'll be trying new counters today. There's a warning you'd not get from a real enemy.
Paul stretched up on his toes to relieve his muscles. He felt solemn with a sudden realization that his life had become filled with swift changes. He crossed to the dummy, slapped the switch on its chest with his rapier tip, and felt the defensive field forcing his blade away.
On guard!
Halleck called, and the dummy pressed the attack. Paul activated his shield, parried, and countered. Halleck watched as he manipulated the controls. His mind seemed to be in two parts, one alert to the needs of the training fight, and the other wandering in fly buzz. I'm the well-trained fruit tree, he thought, full of well-trained feelings and abilities, and all of them grafted onto me, all bearing for someone else to pick. For some reason, he recalled his younger sister, her elfin face so clear in his mind. But she was dead now. In a pleasure house for Harkonnen troops. She had loved pansies. Or was it daisies? He couldn't remember. It bothered him that he couldn't remember. Paul countered a slow swing of the dummy, brought up his left hand en cretisse. The clever little devil, Halleck thought, intent now on Paul's interweaving hand motions. He's been practicing and studying on his own. That's not Duncan's style, and it's certainly nothing I've taught him. This thought only added to Halleck's sadness. I'm infected by mood, he thought. And he began to wonder about Paul, if the boy ever listened fearfully to his pillow throbbing in the night. "If wishes were fishes, we'd all cast nets," he murmured. It was his mother's expression, and he always used it when he felt the blackness of tomorrow on him. Then he thought what an odd expression that was, to be taking to a planet that had never known seas or fishes.
U.E. Wellington, Standard 10,082 to 10,191, Medical Doctor of the Souk School, graduated Standard 10,112, married Juana Marcus, Bene Gesserit, Standard 10,092 to 10,186, chiefly noted as betrayer of Duke Leto Atreides. CF Bibliography, Appendix 7, Imperial Conditioning and Betrayal, the... From Dictionary of Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
Although he heard Dr. Yue enter the training room, noting the stiff deliberation of the man's pace, Paul remained stretched out, face down on the exercise table where the masseurs had left him. He felt deliciously relaxed after the workout with Gurney Halleck.
"You do look comfortable," said Yue
in his calm, high-pitched voice. Paul raised his head, saw the man's stick figure standing several paces away, took in at a glance the wrinkled black clothing, the square block of a head with purple lips and drooping moustache, the diamond tattoo of Imperial Conditioning on his forehead, the long black hair caught in the Souk School's silver ring at the left shoulder.
"You'll be happy to hear we haven't time for regular lessons today," Yue said. "Your father will be along presently."
Paul sat up.
"However, I've arranged for you to have a film book viewer and several lessons during the crossing to Arrakis."
"Oh." Paul began pulling on his clothes. He felt excitement that his father would be coming. They had spent so little time together since the Emperor's command to take over the fief of Arrakis. Yue crossed to the L table, thinking, how the boy has filled out these past few months. Such a waste. Oh, such a sad waste. And he reminded himself, I must not falter. What I do is done to be certain my Juana can no longer be hurt by the Harkonnen beasts. Paul joined him at the table, buttoning his jacket.
What'll I be studying on the way across? Ah, the tyrannic life forms of Arrakis. The planet seems to have opened its arms to certain tyrannic life forms. It's not clear how. I must seek out the planetary ecologist when we arrive, a Dr. Kynes, and offer my help in the investigation.
And Yue thought, what am I saying? I play the hypocrite even with myself.
Will there be something on the Fremen?
Paul asked.
The Fremen?
Yue drummed his fingers on the table, caught Paul staring at the nervous motion, withdrew his hand.
"Maybe you have something on the whole Arrakeen population," Paul said. "Yes, to be sure," Yue said. "There are two general separations of the people. Fremen, they are one group, and the others are the people of the Graben, the Sink, and the Pan. There's some intermarriage, I'm told. The women of Pan and Sink villages prefer Fremen husbands. Their men prefer Fremen wives. They have a saying, polish comes from the cities, wisdom from the desert.
Do you have pictures of them?
I'll see what I can get you. The most interesting feature, of course, is their eyes. Totally blue, no whites in them.
Mutation?
No, it's linked to a saturation of the blood with melange.
The Fremen must be brave to live at the edge of that desert.
By all accounts, Yue said, they compose poems to their knives. Their women are as fierce as the men. Even Fremen children are violent and dangerous. You'll not be permitted to mingle with them, I dare say.
Paul stared at Yue, finding in these few glimpses of the Fremen a power of words that caught his entire attention. What a people to win as allies.
And the worms? Paul asked. What?
I'd like to study more about the sandworms.
Ah, to be sure. I've a film book on a small specimen, only 110 metres long and 22 metres in diameter. It was taken in the northern latitudes. Worms of more than 400 metres in length have been recorded by reliable witnesses,
and there's reason to believe even larger ones exist. Paul glanced down at a conical projection chart of the northern Arakene latitudes spread on the table. The desert belt and south polar regions are marked uninhabitable. Is it the worms? And the storms? But any place can be made habitable. If it's economically feasible, Yui said. Arrakis has many costly perils. He smoothed his drooping moustache. Your father will be here soon. Before I go, I've a gift for you, something I came across in packing. He put an object on the table between them, black, oblong, no larger than the end of Paul's thumb. Paul looked at it. Yui noted how the boy did not reach for it and thought, how cautious he is. It's a very old orange Catholic Bible made for space travellers. Not a film book, but actually printed on filament paper. It has its own magnifier and electrostatic charge system. He picked it up, demonstrated. The book is held closed by the charge, which forces against spring-locked covers. You press the edge, thus, and the pages you've selected repel each other and the book opens. It's so small, but it has 1,800 pages. You press the edge thus and so, and the charge moves ahead one page at a time as you read. Never touch the actual pages with your fingers. The filament tissue is too delicate. He closed the book, handed it to Paul. Try it. Yui watched Paul work the page adjustment, thought, I salve my own conscience. I give him the surcease of religion before betraying him. Thus may I say to myself that he has gone where I cannot go. This must have been made before film books, Paul said. It's quite old. Let it be our secret, eh? Your parents might think it too valuable for one so young. And Yui thought, his mother would surely wonder at my motives. Well, Paul closed the book, held it in his hand. If it's so valuable. Indulge an old man's whim, Yui said. It was given to me when I was very young. And he thought, I must catch his mind as well as his cupidity. Open it to 467 Kalima, where it says, From water does all life begin. There's a slight notch on the edge of the cover to mark the place. Paul felt the cover, detected two notches, one shallower than the other. He pressed the shallower one and the book spread open on his palm, its magnifier sliding into place. Read it aloud, Yui said. Paul wet his lips with his tongue, read, Think you of the fact that a deaf person cannot hear? Then what deafness may we not all possess? What senses do we lack that we cannot see and cannot hear another world all around us? What is there around us that we cannot... Stop it! Yui barked. Paul broke off, stared at him. Yui closed his eyes, fought to regain composure. What perversity caused the book to open at my Wanna's favourite passage? He opened his eyes, saw Paul staring at him. Is something wrong? Paul asked. I'm sorry, Yui said. That was my dead wife's favourite passage. It's not the one I intended you to read. It brings up memories that are painful. There are two notches, Paul said. Of course, Yui thought. Wanna marked her passage. His fingers are more sensitive than mine and found her mark. It was an accident. No more. You may find the book interesting, Yui said. It has much historical truth in it as well as good ethical philosophy. Paul looked down at the tiny book in his palm, such a small thing. Yet it contained a mystery. Something had happened while he read from it. He had felt something stir his terrible purpose. Your father will be here any minute, Yui said. Put the book away and read it at your leisure. Paul touched the edge of it as Yui had shown him. The book sealed itself. He slipped it into his tunic. For a moment there, when Yui had barked at him, Paul had feared the man would demand the book's return. I thank you for the gift, Dr. Yui, Paul said, speaking formally. It will be our secret. If there is a gift of favour you wish from me, please do not hesitate to ask. I need for nothing, Yui said. And he thought, why do I stand here torturing myself, and torturing this poor lad, though he does not know it? Oi! Damn those Harkonnen beasts! Why did they choose me for their abomination?
How do we approach the study of Muad'Dib's father? A man of surpassing warmth and surprising coldness was the Duke Leto Atreides. Yet many facts open the way to this duke: his abiding love for his Bene Gesserit lady, the dreams he held for his son, the devotion with which men served him. You see him there, a man snared by destiny, a lonely figure with his light dimmed behind the glory of his son. Still, one must ask, what is the son but an extension of the father? From Muad'Dib, Family Commentaries by the Princess Irulan.
Paul watched his father enter the training room, saw the guards take up stations outside. One of them closed the door. As always, Paul experienced a sense of presence in his father, someone totally here. The Duke was tall, olive-skinned. His thin face held harsh angles warmed only by deep, grey eyes. He wore a black working uniform with red armorial hawk crest at the breast. A silvered shield belt with a patina of much use girded his narrow waist.
Hard at work, son?
He crossed to the L table, glanced at the papers on it, swept his gaze around the room and back to Paul. He felt tired, filled with the ache of not showing his fatigue. I must use every opportunity to rest during the crossing to Arrakis, he thought. There'll be no rest on Arrakis.
Not very hard. Everything's so...
Yes. Well, tomorrow we leave. It'll be good to get settled in our new home. Put all this upset behind.
Paul nodded, suddenly overcome by memory of the Reverend Mother's words. For the father, nothing.
Father, will Arrakis be as dangerous as everyone says?
The Duke forced himself to the casual gesture, sat down on a corner of the table, smiled. A whole pattern of conversation welled up in his mind, the kind of thing he might use to dispel the vapours in his men before a battle. The pattern froze before it could be vocalised, confronted by the single thought, this is my son.
It'll be dangerous.
Howard tells me we have a plan for the Fremen.
Paul wondered, why don't I tell him what that old woman said? How did she seal my tongue? The Duke noted his son's distress.
As always, Hawat sees the main chance, but there's much more. I see also the Combiné Honnête Aubert Advancère Mercantile, the Chom Company. By giving me Arrakis, His Majesty is forced to give us a Chom directorship. A subtle game.
Chom controls the spice.
And Arrakis, with its spice, is our avenue into Chom. There's more to Chom than melange.
Did the Reverend Mother warn you?
Paul clenched his fists, feeling his palms slippery with perspiration. The effort it had taken to ask that question.
Hawat tells me she frightened you with warnings about Arrakis. Don't let a woman's fears cloud your mind. No woman wants her loved ones endangered. The hand behind those warnings was your mother's. Take this as a sign of her love for us.
Does she know about the Fremen?
Yes, and about much more.
What?
And the Duke thought, the truth could be worse than he imagines. But even dangerous facts are valuable, if you've been trained to deal with them. And there's one place where nothing has been spared for my son. Dealing with dangerous facts. This must be leavened, though. He is young.
Few products escape the Chom touch. Logs, donkeys, horses, cows, lumber, dung, sharks, whale fur. The most prosaic and the most exotic. Even our poor pundi rice from Caladan. Anything the guild will transport. The art forms of Ikaz, the machines of Richesi and Ix. But all fades before Melange. A handful of spice will buy a home on Tupoli. It cannot be manufactured. It must be mined on Arrakis. It is unique, and it has true geriatric properties.
And now we control it.
To a certain degree. But the important thing is to consider all the houses that depend on Chome profits. And think of the enormous proportion of those profits dependent upon a single product. The spice. Imagine what would happen if something should reduce spice production.
Whoever had stockpiled melange could make a killing.
Others would be out in the cold.
The Duke permitted himself a moment of grim satisfaction, looking at his son and thinking how penetrating, how truly educated that observation had been. He nodded.
The Harkonnens have been stockpiling for more than 20 years.
They mean spice production to fail and you to be blamed.
They wish the Atreides' name to become unpopular. Think of the Landsraad houses that look to me for a certain amount of leadership. Their unofficial spokesman. Think how they'd react if I were responsible for a serious reduction in their income. After all, one's own profits come first. The great convention be damned. You can't let someone pauperize you.
A harsh smile twisted the Duke's mouth.
They'd look the other way, no matter what was done to me.
Even if we were attacked with atomics?
Nothing that flagrant. No open defiance of the convention, but almost anything else short of that. Perhaps even dusting and a bit of soil poisoning.
Then why are we walking into this?
Paul, knowing where the trap is, that's the first step in evading it. This is like single combat, son, only on a larger scale. A feint within a feint within a feint, seemingly without end. The task is to unravel it. Knowing that the Harkonnens stockpile melange, we ask another question. Who else is stockpiling? That's the list of our enemies.
Who?
Certain houses we knew were unfriendly, and some we'd thought friendly. We need not consider them for the moment, because there is one other much more important. Our beloved Padishah Emperor.
Paul tried to swallow in a throat suddenly dry.
Couldn't you convene the Landsraad? Expose—
Make our enemy aware we know which hand holds the knife? Ah, now, Paul, we see the knife now. Who knows where it might be shifted next? If we put this before the Landsraad, it'd only create a great cloud of confusion. The Emperor would deny it. Who could gainsay him? All we'd gain is a little time while risking chaos. And where would the next attack come from?
All the houses might start stockpiling spice.
Our enemies have a head start. Too much of a lead to overcome.
The Emperor. That means the Sardaukar.
Disguised in Harkonnen livery, no doubt. But the soldier fanatics, nonetheless.
How can Fremen help us against Sardaukar?
Did Hawat talk to you about Seleucus Secundus?
The Emperor's prison planet? No.
What if it were more than a prison planet, Paul? There's a question you never hear asked about the Imperial Corps of Sardaukar. Where do they come from?
From the prison planet.
They come from somewhere.
But the supporting levies the Emperor demands from—
That's what we're led to believe. They're just the Emperor's levies, trained young and superbly. You hear an occasional muttering about the Emperor's training cadres, but the balance of our civilization remains the same. The military forces of the Landsraad great houses on one side, the Sardaukar and their supporting levies on the other. And their supporting levies, Paul. The Sardaukar remain the Sardaukar.
But every report on Seleucus Secundus says SS is a hell world.
Undoubtedly. But if you are going to raise tough, strong, ferocious men, what environmental conditions would you impose on them?
How could you win the loyalty of such men?
There are proven ways. Play on the certain knowledge of their superiority, the mystique of secret covenant, the esprit of shared suffering. It can be done. It has been done on many worlds in many times.
Paul nodded, holding his attention on his father's face. He felt some revelation impending.
Consider Arrakis. When you get outside the towns and garrison villages, it's every bit as terrible a place as Seleucus Secundus.
Paul's eyes went wide.
The Fremen!
We have there the potential of a core as strong and deadly as the Sardaukar. It'll require patience to exploit them secretly and wealth to equip them properly. But the Fremen are there, and the spice wealth is there. You see now why we walk into Arrakis, knowing the trap is there.
Don't the Harkonnens know about the Fremen?
The Harkonnens sneered at the Fremen, hunted them for sport, never even bothered trying to count them. We know the Harkonnen policy with planetary populations. Spend as little as possible to maintain them.
The metallic threads in the hawk symbol above his father's breast glistened as the Duke shifted his position.
You see?
We're negotiating with the Fremen right now.
I sent a mission headed by Duncan Idaho. A proud and ruthless man, Duncan, but fond of the truth. I think the Fremen will admire him. If we're lucky, they may judge us by him. Duncan, the Moral.
Duncan, the Moral, and Gurney, the Valorous.
You name them well.
And Paul thought, Gurney's one of those the Reverend Mother meant, a supporter of worlds, the valor of the brave.
Gurney tells me you did well in weapons today.
That isn't what he told me.
I figured Gurney to be sparse with his praise. He says you have a nicety of awareness, in his own words, of the difference between a blade's edge and its tip.
Gurney says there's no artistry in killing with the tip, that it should be done with the edge.
Gurney's a romantic. I'd sooner you never had to kill. But if the need arises, you do it however you can. Tip or edge.
The Duke looked up at the skylight, on which the rain was drumming. Seeing the direction of his father's stare, Paul thought of the wet skies out there, a thing never to be seen on Arrakis from all accounts, and this thought of skies put him in mind of the space beyond.
Are the guild ships really big?
The Duke looked at him.
This will be your first time off planet. Yes, they're big. We'll be riding a Highliner because it's a long trip. A Highliner is truly big. Its hold will tuck all our frigates and transports into a little corner. We'll be just a small part of the ship's manifest.
And we won't be able to leave our frigates?
That's part of the price you pay for guild security. There could be Harkonnen ships right alongside us, and we'd have nothing to fear from them. The Harkonnens know better than to endanger their shipping privileges.
I'm going to watch our screens and try to see a guildsman.
You won't. Not even their agents ever see a guildsman. The guild's as jealous of its privacy as it is of its monopoly. Don't do anything to endanger our shipping privileges, Paul.
Do you think they hide because they've mutated and don't look human anymore?
Who knows? It's a mystery we're not likely to solve. We've more immediate problems. Among them, you.
Me?
Your mother wanted me to be the one to tell you, son. You see, you may have Mentat capabilities.
Paul stared at his father, unable to speak for a moment. Then,
a Mentat? Me? But I...
Hawat agrees, son. It's true.
But I thought Mentat training had to start during infancy and the subject couldn't be told because it might inhibit the early...
Paul broke off, all his past circumstances coming to focus in one flashing computation.
I see.
A day comes when the potential Mentat must learn what's being done. it may no longer be done to him. The Mentat has to share in the choice of whether to continue or abandon the training. Some can continue. Some are incapable of it. Only the potential Mentat can tell this for sure about himself.
Paul rubbed his chin. All the special training from Hawat and his mother, the mnemonics, the focusing of awareness, the muscle control and sharpening of sensitivities, the study of languages and nuances of voices, all of it clicked into a new kind of understanding in his mind.
You'll be the Duke someday, son. A Mentat Duke would be formidable indeed. Can you decide now, or do you need more time?
I'll go on with the training.
Formidable indeed.
Paul saw the proud smile on his father's face. The smile shocked Paul. It had a skull look on the Duke's narrow features. Paul closed his eyes, feeling the terrible purpose reawaken within him. Perhaps being a Mentat is terrible purpose, he thought. But even as he focused on this thought, his new awareness denied it.
With the Lady Jessica and Arrakis, the Bene Gesserit system of sowing implant legends through the Missionaria Protectiva came to its full fruition. The wisdom of seeding the known universe with a prophecy pattern for the protection of Bene Gesserit personnel has long been appreciated, but never have we seen a condition ut extremis with more ideal mating of person in preparation. The prophetic legends had taken on Arrakis, even to the extent of adopted labels, including Reverend Mother, Canto in Respondu, and most of the Sharia Panoplia Propheticus. And it is generally accepted now that the Lady Jessica's latent abilities were grossly underestimated. From Analysis, The Erekine Crisis, by the Princess Irulan, Private Circulation Bene Gesserit, file number AR81088587.
All around the Lady Jessica, piled in corners of the Arakine Great Hall, mounded in the open spaces, stood the packaged freight of their lives. Boxes, trunks, cartons, cases, some partly unpacked. She could hear the cargo handlers from the guild shuttle depositing another load in the entry. Jessica stood in the center of the hall. She moved in a slow turn, looking up and around at shadowed carvings, crannies, and deeply recessed windows. This giant anachronism of a room reminded her of the sisters' hall at her Bene Gesserit school. But at the school, the effect had been of warmth. Here, all was bleak stone. Some architect had reached far back into history for these buttressed walls and dark hangings, she thought. The arched ceiling stood two stories above her, with great crossbeams she felt sure had been shipped here to Arrakis across space at monstrous cost. No planet of this system grew trees to make such beams, unless the beams were imitation wood. She thought not. This had been the government mansion in the days of the old empire. Costs had been of less importance then. It had been before the Harkonnens and their new megalopolis of Carthag, a cheap and brassy place some 200 kilometres northeast across the broken land. Leto had been wise to choose this place for his seat of government. The name, Arakine, had a good sound, filled with tradition. And this was a smaller city, easier to sterilize and defend. Again there came the clatter of boxes being unloaded in the entry. Jessica sighed. Against a carton to her right stood the painting of the Duke's father. Wrapping twine hung from it like a frayed decoration. A piece of the twine was still clutched in Jessica's left hand. Beside the painting lay a black bull's head mounted on a polished board. The head was a dark island in a sea of wadded paper. Its plaque lay flat on the floor, and the bull's shiny muzzle pointed at the ceiling as though the beast were ready to bellow a challenge into this echoing room. Jessica wondered what compulsion had brought her to uncover those two things first, the head and the painting. She knew there was something symbolic in the action. Not since the day when the Duke's buyers had taken her from the school had she felt this frightened and unsure of herself. The head and the picture. They heightened her feelings of confusion. She shuddered, glanced at the slit windows high overhead. It was still early afternoon here, and in these latitudes the sky looked black and cold, so much darker than the warm blue of Caladan. A pang of homesickness throbbed through her. So far away, Caladan.
Here we are.
The voice was Duke Leto's.